Last Word on Today FM.
I'm delighted that Miguel Delaney, the chief football writer with The Independent, is here with us in studio today, back home in Dublin. He's always on the phone for matches in England and around Europe. Miguel, great to see you. Thanks for coming in to talk about your new book, States of Play, How Sportswashing Took Over the World. So, great job of research and of storytelling, but what brought you to this? Why is this important to you?
Well, I suppose at the core, ultimately, as someone who loves football, which is partly why I got into journalism and got into this strand of it, really. But I think the game is in a curious place. Yes, it's arguably more popular than anything ever that's ever existed in history, which is an argument I quote Tom Holland making in the book. But that immense popularity hasn't exactly been channeled well by the game. And it's led to a lot of problems. I think we're seeing the manifestation of those problems in a lot of the stuff we talk about every week, say the City hearing, various legal cases.
Sorry, this is Manchester City and the belief that they have effectively financially doped to get to the top.
Yeah, and even the very idea that only few clubs can win. I mean, you're going to have to look at your own club, man, Leeds United. This is a club that was one of England's great establishments. And yet at this point, it would be considered a miracle if they even finished in the Champions League. So something has gone very wrong with football. And there's all sorts of powers far greater than the game exerting influence on it. That was something I felt worthy of looking at anyway. And ultimately, I suppose, it's about trying to fix football and make it better. From a kind of a purely professional perspective as well, I suppose, in my job at The Independent, I'd been covering a lot of these issues and themes in different ways over the past few years, from sports washing, City ownership, say the build-up to the Qatar World Cup, the influence of money, the Super League, which is almost kind of a distillation of a lot of these issues. And I felt there was something linking all these things together that was worth exploring. And I suppose because you can only tell that in something as long as a book, that's where it came from.
Sport in America always fascinates me because America, where there's so much money in television and advertising for American football, for colleges football, for basketball, for baseball, and some of the players get spectacularly rich, but they do tend to run it well as businesses. And then you look at football, which globally is even more popular, and it seems that it's just so badly run a lot of the time that there's enormous sums of money which seem to be applied badly. Is that a fair assessment?
I think that's exactly it. And football in that sense has become, I suppose, an echo of the wider world. And I suppose that's what a lot of this book is about. It's about how football sits in that wider world and the forces exerted upon it. And you're absolutely spot on. I mean, whatever you think of American sport, one of its virtues is that by the end of the season, there's a good chance it'll be a different champion. And I think that's almost, that's supposed to be really what like the ethos of sport is about. That you go, you play a game, and there's a chance you win. That's where the excitement comes from. That's where the attraction comes from. And yet, despite football having an advantage over every single sport by some distance and how globally popular it is, despite what that should give you, the economic model it's embraced, which is basically a completely open free market. As someone put me through the book, it's got fewer checks than international banking. That what that free market does is just, I mean, and Silvio Berlusconi described the virtuous cycle. He was former owner of Milan, went on to become Prime Minister of Italy, very much of that sort of economic persuasion. But what that does is, when it's so open like that, you buy star players bring in more commercial interest, you buy more star players, you get more commercial interest, until gradually a few clubs are growing to a certain size that they start to consume the rest of the game. And I think that's exactly what's happening.
Just coming back to the point, because I recently was doing an event where I actually interviewed Steve Peluccia, who is co-owner of the Boston Celtics in basketball, who've recently won their second title in 22 years. He's also co-owner of Atalanta, which won the Europa League last year. But you think about Boston Celtics, two titles in 22 years. That goes to the point that this is regarded as one of the most successful, best-run basketball teams in the United States of America. And yet, the Spanish league, it's between Barcelona and Real Madrid, with the very occasional interloping by the likes of Atletico or Girona gets into the top four. The English league now totally taken over by Manchester City. Until recent years when they got done for financial doping. Juventus running Bayern Munich until this year, running, what was it, 9 titles in
11
a row?
And people, one thing you always hear in this when you have these debates is, oh, it's always been like this. The big clubs have always won. But it wasn't. Even if you look at the Bayern Munich, up until this run, they'd never won more than three titles in a row. And like as recently as 2007, it was Schalke and Stuttgart going for the title.
And if you go back to, I'm a lot older than you, but you go back to the 70s when I started following football in England, league titles would have been won by Arsenal, Derby, Leeds United, Liverpool, up into the 80s, Aston Villa, Nottingham Forest coming through. There was always great jeopardy and drama in football, which doesn't actually exist anymore. The teams are scrapping it out to be top four rather than winners, which is what Manchester United is essentially now in that particular place.
But I think it's an absolutely key point, and this comes to much bigger issues as regards the authorities of football. Because you think about it, FIFA, UEFA, even the Premier League, in all of their literature, and I think this is particularly true of UEFA, given they kind of run the Champions League, they never actually think about arguments like, well, how many clubs should win a league in a given period? What points are healthy as a threshold to win the league, and how do we get there? Because competitive team sport doesn't happen by accident. You need to keep teams close to basically put on the business of sport. But they don't think, they just, instead, a lot of these bodies have entered the race of just accumulating wealth themselves.
Frank Pelusio actually said to me, it is a weakness of European football that the winning is too concentrated and too small a number of teams. Now, Atalanta have bucked the trend, even in the 2 years that he's been involved in it, to come through and win the Europa League. But how much of this, though, can go back to not long after the turn of the century? And I would have said two things in particular. Real Madrid's decision to invest so heavily in Galacticos, spending an absolute fortune, but possibly even more importantly, Roman Abramovich, the Russian oligarch, multi-billionaire, deciding not just to buy Chelsea, but to run it at significant losses for decades.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly it. And the point about when only a few clubs can win, and why this disparity is a problem, not just for how the game is played and who lifts the trophies at the end. It's also an issue because when a select group of clubs can grow to that size, it means they have immense power in terms of financial capital, but also political capital. And that's what attracts wider interests that ultimately are not interested in what's good for football. As you say, Perez's first Galactico team and the decision to prize Figo away from Barcelona in the way he did and the spectacle about it, I think that first puts clubs almost on another plane, this international plane. And again, it's no coincidence this happens at the dawn of the internet, really, because at that point, clubs aren't just about who can fill their stadium or who gets to see them on TV. That's where their limits are. Suddenly, their potential support base is limitless. And then the official story with Abramovich, say, is that he went to that famous Manchester United Real Madrid game where Ronaldo scores a hat-trick, is transfixed by the spectacle, and wants to buy a club because it's fun. We now know, not that we could say it for 18 years because he was so litigious, that there was very likely state influence there. He'd already vetted Putin's parliament at that point. This is a point where there's so much Russian money flooding into London, and it just feels a logical extension that one of the oligarchs who were so enthralled to Putin buy a football institution too. And what Abramovich does, even beyond those political connections, it's amazing now how just it changes the entire profile of football. I mean, if you look at the Premier League just before the Abramovich takeover, okay, it's beginning to get hugely international popular, it's beginning to maybe catch up with Serie A, but all of its owners are either British or British-based. And while I'm not saying that it should be kind of xenophobic in that sense, the point is more how parochial it was. You had owners you could see on the street, or at least see driving by in the limo. Whereas Abramovich is someone, he's not just a totally different sphere of wealth. He's basically someone, nobody knows what he's thinking. And is that really healthy for something that is supposed to be, a local institution?
You see, what also fascinates me about the English Premiership in particular is at a time when British culturally moved towards Brexit and isolating themselves economically and socially and culturally from Europe.
Yeah.
They're one of the big showpieces of British culture. Its top football league has become utterly international to the extent where you hardly have an English manager in the top flight, where you have players coming from every part of the world. Truly, in some respects, a brilliant global league, which is looked at from all over, yet taking place in a country that otherwise has turned itself inwards.
Yeah, it's remarkable. But then I would say that the Premier League is actually at this point, it's this almost an international company, almost an international media rights company, really, that happens to be based in England, and basically and trading off English football identity, but really becoming something more. And that, of course, is, I would say, an extension of many of the same forces that led to Brexit, which is that the Premier League, from very early on, willingly embraced that sort of new Labour creed of any foreign investment is good investment. I've got like a story in the first chapter of the book. I mean, it ends at that point of the economic crash, which is, of course, key, not just what it does to the world, but also what it does to football. Prior to that, a lot of the Gulf economies, they were trying to get meetings with, say, the UK government, and would often struggle. As soon as the crash happens, meetings are calendars are cleared the next morning. So I've got a story in the book, and I've heard this from people who were in the room, of Gordon Brown and some of his ministers sitting with some of the most influential figures in Qatar, one of them being the former Prime Minister, who was also the father of the Sheikh Jassim that tried to buy Manchester United 2 years ago. And that meeting opens with the question to the Qatari delegates, are you going to buy a football club? And because this was just the attitude. And hence, when Abramovich happened, and it's incredible to think, given the effect of Abramovich, when that happens, the Premier League doesn't even convene a special meeting. People just see it as, well, this is interesting.
And he wasn't the only Russian oligarch to get involved in top flight English clubs either. But then the Arab money coming in, and not just Qatar, because Abu Dhabi and Saudi Arabia into Newcastle United, again, it has distorted the economics of the game and then the fairness of competition, that there were owners prepared to come in and not just take losses for a period, but to take sustained losses because of other sports washing requirements.
Yeah, you mentioned that as well earlier with Abramovich, and I think that's why it's so key in terms of the transformation. So if you say when Abramovich comes in alone, that's at a period where football is financially stretched by its wage race. They have to bring in FFP actually because...
Financial fair play.
Yeah. Which basically just cost control, because clubs are agreeing transfer deals where they're paying 3 instalments and they have no idea if they can pay the second. Leeds are a great victim of this. The effect that means right down to League of Ireland level, wages are going unpaid. I mean, I have stories with people who put FFP together. Like they were thinking of it because basically kids were getting Christmas presents. And then suddenly you have Abramovich coming in. And not only can he pay a transfer fee all in one, he can go to West Ham for Joe Cole and the money's in the account within half an hour. So that has a huge influence. Obviously, when you're talking about state money, that becomes of a completely different profile. And Abramovich is influential in that sense, because in the initial discussions when Abu Dhabi sought to buy Manchester City, Abramovich pointed to that this is what this can do.
And the concentration of wealth means you get a concentration of the best players in the clubs. It means that some very, very good players very rarely see playing time because they just become squad members, whereas in previous generations, they would have been playing maybe a mid-table team, but you would have enjoyed actually seeing them. But what about the argument, though, that it actually has made for better football and a better spectacle?
I think that's something I discuss in the book. And I think it's undeniably true that concentration of wealth has created these super squads that I've never seen before in football. And I think we probably saw the pinnacle of that in, say, the Champions League between 2015 and 2019, just before COVID, actually. And COVID, or really its effects, are almost a key story, especially in terms of, or a key part of the story, especially in terms of what happened next. And I suppose the pinnacle of that was all those comebacks, say, in that week where Liverpool came back against Barcelona, then the next night Spurs come back against Ajax. And I think we're probably seeing this at the moment. That has now tipped over into a point where a lot of the big games even don't feel like they matter as much, because so many of the big clubs win so many of their matches. I mean, look what's happened in the Premier League. It sold itself as the most unpredictable league in the world. And right now, it's the most predictable in Europe. It's suddenly, because of what's
happened... Well, it's an utter shock when Manchester City lose 3 games in a row, albeit in 3 different competitions.
Exactly. I mean, I can remember, say, you know, when Ferguson's United lost like 3 in a row in 97, say, or 96, 97. And yes, it was a tremor, but it's not kind of the massive shock in the same way it is now, because this shouldn't be possible now. But there is an important point there. I mean, you reference players and the effect in that sense. But even if you think about it in basic terms as well. So for one side of clubs like Manchester City or like Bayern or like Paris Saint-Germain or Juventus, and they're all 4 different ownerships, it should be stressed, or 4 different types of ownerships, the value of winning becomes less because they do it all the time. And on the other side, you have swathes and swathes of clubs who just can't really think about winning at all.
But actually, it's funny you mentioned Bayern Munich, because sometimes the German model of ownership is held up. And then it's said, well, actually, that means that even Bayern Munich and German teams lose players to England or to Spain that they can't hold on to the best players. But it's always struck me that it's quite ridiculous in Germany that whenever a team comes through as a challenger to Bayern Munich, that at the end of the season, it seems Bayern Munich then pick off their best player or two.
Well, that I have an issue with that argument because that is always held up as a problem of Germany's 50 plus one model where the fans have this kind of controlling share of the club. It's not a problem of that because if it was, you'd only see these issues in Germany. But you see them in every model of league and every model of ownership. That is a product of Bayern Munich being part of this really global football system where for two decades they're guaranteed to benefit from Champions League money, and in many cases Bayern have specifically lobbied for more money to come there the way of them and the biggest clubs, and they're suddenly dropped in this league that is actually one of the few leagues along with Sweden, say, that is actually trying to solve these problems.
But they have the advantage of all the money they have.
If 50 plus one was spread around Europe, say, a lot of these problems are eliminated at source.
Miguel, you spend every week going to a variety of football matches, and your most important thing to do is to write the match reports and to get the stories of what's going on with players and the rest of it. But how did the people who run and control the money and who have the power of football react to you asking all of these questions with the intention of doing a book on it?
Usually it's actually to not engage. And I found where you get the most value is basically people speaking off the record. That's where most...
That tends to happen a lot where there's money and power involved in big business.
Exactly, yeah. And it's amazing how so many people will say one thing in public and then say the exact opposite in private. Be that about kind of the rise of the Saudi Pro League. So say with the Saudi Pro League, there's a classic example. One of the very clever things that the Saudi Pro League have done that, say, the Qatar World Cup didn't do was, and I detail this in the book, in the 3-month build-up to the Saudi Pro League, they essentially got so many key stakeholders in football, so many power brokers in football, be it executives that have been at big clubs, the main agents, invited them over to all these big meetings in London or in Riyadh, and essentially like, didn't necessarily co-opt them, but then suddenly the dialogue is open with them. And suddenly it just mitigates discussion in that way.
Well, we didn't get into a chance to talk about how much money the agents have been making out of this, which is quite extraordinary when you see the figures published every year. But I suppose the reason why a lot of this hasn't changed is there's too much money been made by a small number of people for them to want to change anything, even if it would be to the benefit of football and for the better enjoyment of the fans.
Well, and there's a very relevant issue there that I suppose relates to that idea I put forward earlier, that FIFA, UEFA, the Premier League, they don't think in terms of what's actually good for the sport as it's run in that sense, and who should win. Because exactly that, as you say, there should be forces in the game. Like, really, this should be the job of FIFA and underneath them UEFA to start thinking about this. But what are those bodies now? All right, they're supposed to be the ultimate regulators, the safeguards. Instead, they have these bizarre political structures that are all based around a single executive president. And like in FIFA's case, they bestow the immense power of the World Cup on one man, or they afford him this power. In UEFA's case, it's the power of the club game through the Champions League and to a lesser extent the European Championships. And then because of that, FIFA, and because they're almost in competition with their own clubs and member associations because they put on events, they just become part of the race. Suddenly, bigger issues in the game, that's not something they're tackling. I mean, there's all sorts of other complications that are discussed.
It's a terrific read. States of Play, How Sports Washing Took Over Football. Miguel Delaney, as ever, thank you for being with us.
Thanks, Matt. The Last Word on Today FM.